This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk with Neil Ferguson about his new biography of Henry Kissinger and find out why he thinks some historians have the wrong view about Kissinger. Joining me first to discuss domestic violence and ways to prevent it, our Director of Family and Community Intervention at the Greater Cincinnati YWCA, Erica Yingling, Vice President of Programming at Women Helping Women, Kendra Massey, and Executive Director of the Women's Crisis Center in Northern Kentucky, Marcia Croxton. You can be part of the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Kendra, Erica, and Marcia, thank you so much for being here this afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
Erica, we hear the term domestic violence quite a bit, but what does it really mean?
Well, domestic violence is about a pattern of behavior that is perpetrated to an intimate partner. And it's really about that pattern and coercive behavioral responses that end up in violence. That violence can either be physical, emotional, psychological. It can be acts of intimidation, but it doesn't always have to be just physical.
So coercive, you mean, but they're trying to control the other partner in this.
It is about that coercive control, so which means it's pattern-based. It's not isolated incident.
Now, I've heard the term intimate partner violence and domestic violence. Are the two terms interchangeable, or there's a difference between the two things?
We use them interchangeably. Domestic violence, I would say, is more of a legal term, and the legal definition varies a little bit from the social definition that Erica just gave. So it's more focused on physical abuse. We know that emotional abuse, though, is a huge part of what's happening for the people that we're working with. So intimate partner violence is a more inclusive term that we tend to use as an agency. The legal definition of domestic violence in Ohio also is limiting around like who the two there has to be a specific relationship between the two individuals.
I was going to say in Kentucky, domestic violence is people that are married, people that are living together, or who have a child in common. So we throw out domestic violence as if it's a brother and a sister beating up each other, but the legal definition for us is that relationship I talked about, the Kentucky definition.
But that differs in Ohio because domestic violence as a legal term can be an isolated incident and punishable by law. So it could be between a mother and a stepson, a stepfather, and a daughter. But that doesn't encompass all of intimate partner violence because that's pattern-based, not an isolated incident.
Hey, Erica, how prevalent is this? I mean, how common is domestic violence or intimate partner violence?
Well, intimate partner violence is very prevalent, and 1 in 3 women are reported to be victims of intimate partner violence in their life. And the statistics for men are 1 in 5, so certainly that's no needle in the haystack for men. That often is underreported and underdisclosed specifically because they are men and sometimes don't feel as if there's support to report the crimes in their communities.
I heard an interesting statistic. The statistic I heard was 1 in 4 women will be victims of domestic violence. So more women will be touched by domestic violence than they will breast cancer, ovarian cancer, or lung cancer combined.
Marcia, who are the victims are, it's more women. Is there a certain age group for women where this is more common? Or
typically, our statistics show between 18 and 34 seem to be the primary individuals that we're seeing.
Yeah, I would say that's consistent for us. National studies say 18 to 24 are most at risk. But as far as people accessing our services, it's very similar, about 18 to 35.
Who are the abusers? Who most typically is abusive?
Well, the majority, and this is not to say anything negative about one gender, but we really have to understand that most of the victims of domestic violence are women, and most of the people who perpetrate acts of violence are men. And that's not all of them, but it is in the majority of cases.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you would like to join our conversation. How often does domestic violence become really severe and even lead to death? How often does that occur?
Well, I will use the State of Ohio's report from last year from the Ohio Domestic Violence Network. There were 111 deaths in the state of Ohio from June 2015 to July of 2016. So it's 111 people who died because of intimate partner violence. Out of those 111, 11 were children. Okay, so you take the other 90, those were generated from 63 cases. So think about that. When you say 63 cases, it means that most of the time a person who's committing a homicide is doing so by also, it's a murder-suicide, killing the children, then killing themselves, or simply just killing the partner or the children in an isolated, singular incident.
So you're talking about children. That's tragic that many children have died in domestic violence incidents. Outside of that, I mean, what kind of impact does this have on children?
Well, on a national level, 15.5 million children are exposed to domestic violence per year. And what we know that it does to a child's brain is impede development. So when we look at exposure to trauma on kids, we really have to look at what age they were, if they're pre-verbal. So we know now children ages 0 to 3 are most affected by the exposure of violence. And it also remains the greatest predictor of victimization as an adult or the perpetration of violence as an adult.
So somebody who sees abuse as a child can become an abuser themselves, is what you're saying, or even a victim themselves?
It creates a greater risk for them to be. Not all children who are abused become perpetrators of violence, but they need positive supports and buffers and protective factors in their life to combat that trauma.
I think also that thinking about children who are going through this trauma, now we're setting them up to fail in school, to have health issues, because they're suffering from traumatic stress. And it becomes a behavior of a flight or fight behavior. And it's gut-wrenching to watch.
Yeah, it really does sound like a Kendra. Did you want to?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's important to make the distinction, though. This is a choice that people choose to behave this way in their relationships. So being exposed to violence as a child does increase risk, but ultimately it's a choice people make.
Right. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to become abusive.
Right. It's
not
going
to become a victim.
It doesn't predetermine that that's going to happen.
When you know a child's been in that situation, how do you intervene? How do you keep them from going down that path?
Well, it's really about looking at what protective factors are in that child's life. So what supports can we provide as agencies to them, whether it's appropriate service recommendations for therapy or even within, if they do come into a shelter space, being able to provide the kids with ongoing support, knowing that they are coming from a crisis situation. So that could be making sure they're in the same school, making sure that they're still in the extracurricular activities they may have been in, or just being positive, partnering with them and empowering them, just how you treat them.
And then the relationship with their safe parent is really important too. So being able to foster that relationship with the parent who is safe.
Mm-hmm. 513-419-7100 to join the conversation. Let's talk with Mary. Mary, good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi, Mary.
Go right ahead.
I called because I just wanted to weigh in with one small comment. I'm so glad that you're doing this program. It's so, so necessary. I shared with him that I was previously in an abusive relationship. I am thankfully now happily married to a wonderful man who I consider to be my partner in all things. And the reason I called is because as I was struggling through trying to decide whether to leave my former spouse, one of the things that I really had trouble doing was identifying myself. I would constantly read the little pamphlets about, you know, are you in a situation that you need to leave? And the language made it difficult for me to find myself in there. And so I kept saying, okay, well, that's not me. That's not me. And the one word in particular that I really struggle with that I still hear being used today is partner. And I just want to challenge the use of the word partner when you're talking about a person who's abusing you. They're not your partner. And I wish that we could find a different word for that.
That's an interesting take, Mary. Thank you for the call.
Mary, thank you for sharing a bit of your story with us. I think it is sometimes difficult for people who are in traumatic and abusive situations to identify or self-identify that, in fact, this is happening to me. We know, at least from my perspective with children, it's a disassociative kind of tactic and a survival tactic. I think about partner, but I wonder, you know, what other kind of language could we use? To me, it's really just about identifying that there has to be some type of intimate relationship for this to occur. But certainly your point is extremely valid and mm-hmm. understanding why it's hard to see ourselves in these situations mm-hmm. and come to terms with it.
Yeah, I think we use the term partner a lot because it feels like the most inclusive term because we know this can happen in all different types of relationships. But yeah, I'd be interested to hear what might be a better term.
Makes you think. It's like, oh, mm-hmm. there must be another way to say it.
She's right. That's not a partner in life.
Right.
But as Kendra is saying, it's kind of a broad, generic term. It's inclusive. So, and you're talking about, in most cases of domestic violence, it's people who know each other where
yes.
this is occurring.
Yes,
it's not
definitely.
A stranger who's mm-hmm. assaulting you. So,
right.
That's an interesting thought. Let's talk to Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
Good. The one thing that I would like to say is I'm continually concerned about the lack of response when we talk about violence against women. I think it's becoming the norm, and I don't know if that's because young girls are now getting into violent relationships with boyfriends, even in teen years, having abusive relationships.
You think we're getting complacent about it, Chris?
I'm thinking so. Even as, you know, you think about the sex trade and the prevalence of it, you know, I've made comments to people about how, you know, the things that are going on with children, babies as young as 6 months old being raped by men, mm-hmm. and there just doesn't seem to be any response. So I'm not surprised that when you talk about now, my earliest memory is my mother standing on one side of the kitchen and my father on the other. My mother had a pot of grease and my father had a knife. That was what we grew up in constantly. And so I understand what that does to children, but I don't know if generationally we are changing because kids are, I mean, you know, you look at the videos of girls fighting each other on these videos now that are popular and these abusive relationships, the girls think it's just what happens. I really think there's a lot of complacency around violence against women, and that's really a little, you know, it's just even this election, and I know it's not gone to court, but we talk about the 13-year-old that's coming up on charges, that's taking Trump to court on charges of rape. I have said that often, and no one responds. Not one response has come from that statement. So I don't know that people are as concerned about violence against women as they used to be.
Let's see what the panel thinks on this.
I certainly agree that there's a normalization of violence against women and girls that is a larger societal and cultural issue, 100%. And I also agree that sometimes people may be viewed as being complacent, but I hope that at least we can bring to the community that our three agencies are far from complacent. We are working better, stronger together to have the best coordinated community response to end violence in our communities. And sometimes we do face a lot of obstacles, but it reminds us that we have to keep continuing because the statistics are not changing. And you're right about that.
I'll say from Women Helping Women perspective, we're seeing increased numbers of services that we're providing. So we've seen in 2016, in the first three quarters of the year, we've provided over 13,000 services. We didn't provide that many services in all of 2015. So we're seeing more people reach out for service. We're also seeing more people reach out with requests for education programs and trainings. And to us, that's hopeful because what that means to us is people do care about the
issue.
You're
seeing an increase in awareness about this problem.
Yeah. Yeah. People are reaching out for help. People mm-hmm. are wanting to talk about the issue. So to us, that doesn't necessarily mean it's happening more. That means people are talking about it more and they want to know more about it and they want to access support.
I think for us, we're really doing a lot of prevention and bystander training so that we as individuals who stand between an abuser and a victim will take action so that bad things don't happen. We're working in the high schools, and we're seeing a dramatic change in the high schools that we're in. Mm-hmm. They're not tolerating any kind of violence, whether it's sexual, bullying, stalking. It's very, it gives me hope. And hopefully we'll put ourselves out of business on the crisis side. That's my goal, is to create prevention services that put us out of business on the crisis intervention side.
I think that's a great point that Marcia made, because the YWCA also provides prevention education and middle and high school students. And last year alone, we served 3,000 students in Hamilton, Claremont, Brown, and Adams counties, where we deliver a curriculum that is a national-based curriculum called Safe Dates, all around consent, healthy relationships, sexual assault, what it means to be a good bystander, an upstander, how to end bullying. So we're really trying to reach young people, and women. Helping Women also has a really robust prevention education service that they provide to thousands of students in our mm-hmm. community.
Yeah, we serve 3,500, I think, between Hamilton and Butler. So that's a lot of students mm-hmm. getting this information.
We will continue our conversation, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us to discuss preventing domestic violence, our Director of Family and Community Intervention at the Greater Cincinnati YWCA, Erica Yingling, Vice President of Programming at Women Helping Women, Kendra Massey, and Executive Director of the Women's Crisis Center in Northern Kentucky, Marcia Croxton. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Tracy. Hi, Tracy.
Hi. I just had a question about, I was in an abusive relationship, and one of the reasons that I had a hard time getting out of it is because no shelters would allow me to take my dogs, and so it became a real point of power in the relationship. If I tried to go anywhere safe, then my partner, we'll use that term loosely, would threaten to harm my dog. So I just wanted to know if there are any kind of resources, if anyone else is in that type of situation, or any shelters that do allow pets.
Hey, Tracy, what finally got you to leave the situation you were in? How did you finally work your way out of that?
It was my family was able to help me, but I mean it was really hard, because obviously there's a horrible psychological dynamic there, but. My family was able to really kind of intervene and thankfully really kind of force my hand after things got pretty bad. So I'm thankful for that.
Well, Tracy, this is Erica from the YWCA, and we have a domestic violence shelter in Hamilton County with 75 beds and one in Claremont County with 14 beds. But we also do partner with our local animal agencies to board animals and keep them safe while residents are in shelter. And certainly this is something, I couldn't give you the exact time of when we started doing it, but it came out probably maybe a decade or so ago when the research suggested and told us really that animal abuse was a form of emotional and psychological coercion, and that a lot of survivors reported not leaving relationships because they were fearful for their pets or their pet's safety. So we really try to make sure if you have an animal, we will accept you into shelter. We certainly accept all service dogs into our shelter, but we will board them for free for you until you are out and have an undisclosed location.
And that happens at the Women's Crisis Center also, because we don't want fear of the pet to keep you from leaving and being safe.
And Tracy, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. What are some other reasons, though, that make it difficult for women to get out of abusive relationships? I mean, a lot of people would say, isn't it just a matter of just walking away from it and just
no.
going away?
No.
Okay, so statistics say that 98% of women don't leave for financial reasons is a huge part, because they have no place to go. Typically, they have been the stay-at-home. He controls the checkbook and the money. And so they don't have any resources to be able to walk out the door, especially if they have children.
Women also or people who are experiencing violence in intimate relationships also don't leave because it's the most dangerous time. It increases lethality, and that means homicide or death. Yes, absolutely. And almost all the reported homicides in the state of Ohio, 86%, they were at the point of separation or leaving or just thinking about leaving. So one of the things is just basic survival and that fear of what's going to happen if they do leave.
Yeah, I think in addition to that, when you look at dynamics of control in relationship, many of those things, the intention is to make the person dependent. And so what we see a lot is survivors of violence being isolated from friends, family, outside support networks. We see financial abuse happening where many times when we're working with clients and they're wanting to leave the relationship, their credit's not great because of things that happened in the relationship. They might have evictions due to the abusive person not paying rent or doing damage to the property. When we look at even children and the involvement there, there might have been threats made towards the children, threats around custody, even threats of self-harm or suicide on the part of the abusive person. It's all manipulation and it's very controlling. And there are so many reasons. I think for most survivors, it's not just one of those. It's a combination of factors and barriers that make it difficult.
And then are there times where the abuser might say, I'm really, really sorry, I'll never do that to you again, but that would be just, that would just be manipulation again.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's not actual guilt like most people, sorrow that most people feel. It's more, maybe I'm going to get caught or maybe they're going to leave me.
513-419-7100. Let's talk to Marlene. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. I wanted to talk about anger management classes and other things that would say something to the abusers on that might be listening. I was in an abusive relationship, and one thing I did was to let all the neighbors hear, make sure they all always heard everything. It was in an apartment, and this overall, it had an effect that helped me because they would sometimes call out things like, don't take that, don't say that to her.
So your neighbors were aware of what was going on and they were backing you up.
Well, not for a long time. You know, it was kind of an intrusion for on their part, but then I just thought, well, if something really happens, they'll hear it and they'll do something. And the abuser scene knows the same thing. So it kind of helped. And now the abuser is not around, but I hear they're much better in general in their relationships and getting just more social help of all kinds. And I know two people that had their partner go to anger management classes. A judge will sometimes insist that, although I do think it's dangerous just to report these things. I think that's right. But I know two people who, but the judge, when they went to court, said, you're going to have to go to anger management classes or I will sentence you to actually, you know, serve some time.
Have to go to jail if you don't take the class. Yes.
Well, yeah. And these helped. They did help. Both people thought that it helped.
Okay.
The abused person.
Well, thank you for sharing your story. I think it's great that you involved your neighbors, and that's like a protective strength. So they really assisted you during that time, and I'm glad you're out of that relationship. One thing I do want to say about anger management is that we know that domestic violence is not about the ability to control anger, because you think about it. These people are outside in the community and their jobs and in public life, and they're able to contain their anger. Okay, and most of the time they're able to manipulate systems because they're so good at containing that anger, and it's coming out to their intimate partner, which is then about the patterns of coercive control. At the YWCA Greater Cincinnati, we have the only batters intervention program in Hamilton County, and it's 28 weeks long. So we're hoping, and we've seen movement where judges are court ordering this to men who come into the criminal justice system. It's called Transform, but anyone can really take this psychoeducational group class that focuses on identifying patterns of coercive control and changing that behavior in the abuser.
She was talking about how her neighbors were aware of what was going on. If you're a friend of someone who might be victimized or you're a family member, what signs do you look for? Because it's not always as obvious as it was in her case. So what do you look for?
think indicators of control, if you can see that. So if someone's, if they behave differently when their partner's there versus when they're not, if they seem shut down, if their partner is speaking for them or seems to be controlling them, I think those are the less obvious things.
Or they used to go out and hang out occasionally, and now they're never going out with friends or unless he is with her.
Well, and a lot of times survivors enter into a very post-traumatic stress disorder state, which looks like anxiety. They're hyper alert. They're constantly scanning their environment for the next danger threat. So it's kind of like survival mode. They could be overly anxious. So that kind of depleted mental health state occurs after long exposure to chronic abuse.
I think she spoke to neighbors who heard the arguments or heard the violence. And I think just being aware of that and being willing to do something about it and not just ignore it when you hear it is really right. important.
We had an email from a listener who says that her college-age daughter was assaulted and is in counseling now. But she's wondering, what can family members do to help? And where can they find local resources, support groups?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, any of our agencies would be a resource. So at Women Helping Women, we do have support groups for survivors, and we do individual support for family and loved ones. So we can talk. We've had family members come in, and what can I say or do to support my loved one, whether it's my daughter or a friend or other family member. And I think realizing that that's really impactful to the family and those close to the survivor is important too. So getting that support for themselves can help them in supporting their loved one.
What are some specific things you can do to support somebody who's going through this?
Listen, validate, empower, believe, never judge them, never say, just leave. I don't understand, why don't you just leave? So,
as we're talking earlier, that's not the easy, that's not an easy thing to
no.
do at all. Yeah.
Right. I was going to say, and safety plan with them mm-hmm. so that they know how they can reach out to you if they need you. But it's truly validating and not asking, why are you staying? Just
right.
don't say that.
And I think, too, being patient with the healing process, because I've had many survivors tell me that they felt like they're getting this pressure from their friends or family to be themselves again or to act, to go out and have fun and not to seem affected by what was happening to them. And they felt pressure around that. And so we encourage survivors, like, be patient with yourselves around the healing process. And it's important family members and friends can be patient, too, and acknowledge that it is a trauma, that it might take some time to be able to move on and to heal.
Is there also a degree of that you need to realize that this has a profound impact on you physically and mentally?
It does.
Not to take it for granted, mm-hmm. because I was reading that the health effects of being abused mm-hmm. are, it's amazing the things that can occur because of this. And then the mental health issues that rise from being a victim of domestic violence are horrendous. So I think you have to give yourself some slack maybe and not be too hard on yourself and realize that it's tough, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I also think about secondary victims, which are those family and friends that also go through some healing because they feel responsible or they could have stopped it. So it's really important that they go through a process themselves.
And it's important to remember, if children are in the home, whether or not they've been actually physically abused, whether or not they've been in the same room where there's been violence, they have still been exposed to that violence, and they need time to heal and really some good intervention services to build back that resiliency.
We had an email from Mike in Clifton. He says he's seen some old movies and TV, and he's kind of surprised at these scenes where slapping or bullying a woman is portrayed as almost a positive thing. So I'm wondering what you think about the media portrayal today, in particular, in regards to violence against women.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, it's interesting. I often think about the old film noir, Gaslight, in which is a term about now that we use about emotional and psychological abuse, But in the film, there's gas lights in this old home, and the husband kept turning them down, and the wife saying, you know, I'm going, the house is getting dimmer. He goes, it's as bright as it ever was. So it's emotional, psychological manipulation, a distortion of reality. And that's certainly a tactic of abuse that we continue to see in pop culture today. I mean, it's probably far more rampant, but it's really nothing new. As Mike was pointing out, it certainly has been present in all of our film and music and media that we watch and see.
I think it challenges Marcia talked about prevention efforts, and when we're talking to students and youth, we're trying to normalize what does a healthy relationship look like and what are healthy relationship mm-hmm. dynamics. And when that's not what youth are seeing on TV or in movies, that's challenging. That makes our job harder to try and promote mm-hmm. healthy relationships and respect and equality.
Kendra, what are you seeing that makes you optimistic that progress is being made on dealing with this issue?
One thing that's optimistic for us is the number of people who reach out and want to have a part in supporting survivors, doing prevention. So we've seen just in the last, really in the last week, I think probably as a result of the election results, people reaching out wanting to volunteer. We've had a huge response, people wanting to say, how can I support your agency in the work that you do? We started our agency a little over a year ago, a youth prevention team, and it's students who've gone through our prevention program who were just really interested and passionate about the issues, who wanted to get more involved. So we have this youth team of volunteers who are building their leadership skills, and they're doing their own events at their school and in the community to try and really promote positive relationships and respect. And to me, that's very hopeful.
I am. Back to the prevention, just the community support for the financial needs for us to be able to roll it out into more schools. And I think the thing that I'm just really hopeful for is the entire faith-based community in Maysville, all denominations, have embraced our prevention strategy and are now pushing it out into their congregations. And so to me, that makes me very hopeful.
So that increase in awareness and people realizing this is a problem.
And being an active bystander that says harming somebody else is not okay. That's not our community norm.
Erica, are there any organizations that are having upcoming seminars or programs that are open to the public about the things about domestic abuse?
Well, one of the things that we are planning, we have in Hamilton County a Children Exposed to Domestic Violence work group, which certainly can be open to community members, is a huge educational summit. It'll be hosted on June 7th, location to be determined, in conjunction with the Mayerson Center for Safe and Healthy Children and Dr. Bob Shapiro. We're going to be looking at all of these things about trauma, toxic stress, the exposure of violence on kids, and then the best answer, which gives me hope every day, what can we do to change the outcome, because kids can experience this, but we can build them back to be successful, positive, and happy and healthy adults.
Kendra, Erica, and Marcia, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Director of Family and Community Intervention at the Greater Cincinnati YWCA, Erica Yingling, Vice President of Programming at Women Helping Women, Kendra Massey, and Executive Director of the Women's Crisis Center in Northern Kentucky, Marcia Croxton. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.